Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Welcome to another episode of Thou Shalt Not Suffer, the Witch Trial Podcast. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack.
Today's guest is the extraordinary author Catherine Howe. We'll speak with her about the causes of the Salem witch hunt and about her new book on pirates. I'm excited to talk about Salem witch hunt again and really curious what her book is about.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what time of year.
It's always Christmas for pirates.
Just like Catherine's other books, you are going to be delighted by the characters and the adventure. Fun getting to hear about it, and it's going to be hard to wait for the publishing.
She has wild swashbuckling shenanigans. But first, on a more serious note, we talk Salem witch trials. What caused them? What didn't cause them? Why Catherine Howe gets fired up about certain topics?
We get to a lot of layers.
We're peeling that onion.
We just take Catherine right into the depths of the mechanics.
We talk about the different spheres that Malcolm Gaskell spoke about that are nested in each other, and how each of those spheres contributed to the witch hunt.
We talk about what kind of perspective do we need to be using when we look back at the individuals that were in a different time in history.
Oh, yes, we do that, don't we? Wow. This is going to be one hell of an episode.
Aren't they all?
Yes, but I have a good feeling about this one. It's going to be something special.
It's another dynamic conversation with a phenomenal author and researcher, and she does not hold back.
She does not. The emotions come out. Be ready. I'm going to talk about before the Salem witch trials, what the conditions were in Massachusetts Bay Colony and Salem Village and Andover. Colonies used to have charters, so they were officially recognized by the English government to govern themselves without direct supervision from the crown and parliament. Massachusetts Bay lost its colonial charter in 1684 when King Charles II revoked it because they had been naughty boys. And when the witch hunt began in early 1692, they still didn't have a charter, so they were in legal limbo. In addition, they were fighting King William's War and still recovering from King Philip's War, which was the costliest and bloodiest of the colonial wars, occurring between 1675 and 1678. In fact, the Massachusetts economy did not recover to pre-war levels until the 1800s after the Revolution. Economic hardship resulting from the wars and the collapse of land speculation were also contributed to by an influx of refugees from the frontier in Maine and New Hampshire. And Essex County, where Salem's located, was especially impacted due to its proximity to that frontier, being the northernmost county in Massachusetts. Many of the settlers of Salem had moved on to Maine and New Hampshire, only to be forced to return when their villages were burned to the ground. Beyond these issues, in Salem, the town had recently gone through a bit of a separation where Salem Village was allowed to begin its own church. In 1689, Salem Village hired the fourth in a series of unpopular ministers, and there were disputes over his contract. So there was a lot of tension in the area. There was also tension in Andover, which was the hardest hit by the witch trials, with some 45 individuals being accused. There was a dispute between two ministers, Francis Dane and Thomas Barnard. Francis Dane was an older gentleman with health issues who was no longer performing full duties as minister. So they had brought in Thomas Barnard, a younger man, to take over some of his duties, but were still paying both men in 1692, leading to tensions within the community that may have fueled some of the allegations there. We'll get into these issues further with Catherine Howe, and specifically we'll be discussing Andover in a few weeks with author Richard Height, and get into more of whether the dispute over the ministers did or did not contribute to witch hunt fever in that community.
That was good, Josh. Thanks, Josh.
You're welcome. It was a fun one to do. And we're going to dig into that stuff some more with our guest.
I am excited to introduce author Catherine Howe, whose works include The Physic Book of Deliverance Stain, Conversion, The Daughters of Temperance Hobb. She's an editor of The Penguin Book of Witches and co-author of Vanderbilt.
We've read that you're actually connected to somebody accused, which is an interesting connection. So can you tell us about who it is that's your ancestor?
A little bit of a funny story. So my last name is Hal. Like, how are you? But with me, I'm one of the witches who was accused towards the beginning of the Salem Panic. And who was put to death was Elizabeth Howe. And she was from the same broad region where my family was from also. So it wasn't a surprise when my aunt, back in the 90s, she did some genealogical research and she figured out that Elizabeth Howe was, I think it's like my eighth great aunt. So it's the lateral thing rather than the direct thing. But at the time, she discovered that Elizabeth Howe was related to us that way, and also that Elizabeth Proctor was also an eighth or ninth great aunt as well, which is not all that surprising given that those communities were pretty small and there were lots of intermarriages between different family groups. So it was in the 90s when I first learned that and thought, of course, it being the 90s and me being a grunge kid, I was like, oh, that's so badass. That's so metal. And it's okay. The greatest thing ever. I didn't give it much thought beyond that until I was actually living in that region, New England, because my family left New England in the 1930s. I grew up with this sense of it as like the motherland, but I didn't actually grow up there myself. So I arrived in this region with this kind of funny twin consciousness of, oh, this is home, but I'm also a stranger here. And so it was being a stranger in this place that I felt this kinship with probably contributed somewhat to my getting started writing fiction. My first book was The Physic Book of Deliverance Stain, which was something I started working on when I was in graduate school at Boston University, and was trying to think about humanity of people living in this time. And maybe a funny little detail. So one of the historians of witchcraft who I really admire the most is a woman, Mary Beth Moore. She wrote a book called The Devil's Snare. Anyone who's interested in Salem has to know Professor Norton's work. Yes. It's just like the kind of detail that she can bring to it. And she writes in a novelistic sort of way. It's just like the most gripping account of Salem ever. And Professor Norton has said that the more you work on witchcraft, the more superstitious you become. And I have to say that this is true. That's evidenced by the anecdote I'm about to tell you. So my first book, The Physic Book of Deliverance Stain, it asked, what if one of the Salem witches was a string but should it be able to take away the colonists' belief, which is to be Martin and have fantasy and Harry Potter's then. And I built that story around a woman named Deliverance Dane, who's a real person. And she was a minor person in the Salem witch crisis. She was accused towards the end of the panic. She's not put to death. She really was a footnote, I think, in real history of Salem. And so I felt like it was okay to build a more fantastical story, because a book is a magical realist story. So I wanted room to have kind of a fantastical story around a real person. And so I picked her because of her obscurity, but also because of her name. Her name is so evocative of this particular moment and time of this subculture that she was living in, Puritan New England, Deliverance Dane. Amazing. So that is why I chose to write about her. That book came out in 2001. And so several years later, I was reflecting about a genealogy website, because of course, for people interested in family history, life's gotten a lot easier over the last couple of years with the advent of digital humanities and so many more ways of doing research online. When my aunt was doing research in the 90s, really hard to do. And now it's actually much more accessible, which is a huge gift. So I'm messing about, point click, and I tell upon Nathaniel Dane, which is actually a main character in the books that I wrote. And I was like, huh, that's a weird coincidence. Who knew? Point click. Well, lo and behold, I learn, because it turns out Deliverance Dane, the real one, is my 8th great grandmother. And so she's more closely related to me, genetically speaking, than Elizabeth Howe, even though Elizabeth Howe might have the same last name. And I had zero idea, no idea whatsoever. And I'd written an entire novel about this person. And wow, that there. She was just hanging out, waiting for me. So I definitely have gotten more superstitious the longer I've worked on the show.
That's a very strange thing to have happen to you. But it turns out that Deliverance Dane is actually my 8th or 9th great grand aunt. And Elizabeth Jackson Howe is also an aunt. And Deliverance Dane, in her confession, says that she worked with Mary Osgood. And that's my grandmother. I connected to a lot of the people you're connected.
So we're cousins, John.
And Sarah's my cousin through Mary Esty.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a small world when you get back to those little towns back there.
It really is, for sure. It's still pretty far back there. It's a long time ago. It was very funny. I once did a book event and someone came up to me, very emotional. And they were, turns out, a descendant of a judge in the Salem trials. And this person wanted very much to personally apologize to me. And I was like, no, really, it's okay. This is not something that you need to feel badly about. This is, everything's fine. But it is interesting to me how close people could feel to people who are living in such a distant time period.
We definitely feel connected to our ancestors. And we talk to a lot of descendants of witch trial victims, and they have an emotional bond with those ancestors. But that was so long ago. Did you get interested in Salem because of your connection with Howe and Proctor?
Partly. I went to graduate school for American and New England Studies, which is interdisciplinary American history. And I actually came to it from an art history background. I have a background in visual culture, the museum here for grads, visual culture, and also material culture, just to say stuff, objects. On a whim, my husband and I moved to Marblehead, Massachusetts, which is a small town on the water close to modern day Salem. We're having this conversation in October, and there was just an article, Boston Globe, about how 100,000 people came to Salem for Halloween. And roaming streets, Salem is a town of 40,000 people. I can't even wrap my head around how many people they cram in this season. And a lot of people come to Salem for Halloween Central. And understandably, but it was interesting to me while I was living in Marblehead and I was studying history, and I was living in a house that was built in 1705. And so one thing I have to say is people associate me so closely with Salem because I've written some of Salem Fortune. I grew up in Houston, Texas, Okay. So the oldest building extant in Houston, Texas is a wine bar that was originally built as a bakery and it's from 1856. So the oldest building in the entire city that I grew up in is 6 years younger than the new addition of the house that I was living in Marblehead, Massachusetts. Earlier when I was talking about having a sense of home, but being a stranger there, I brought my new South eyes to this incredibly old environment because Marblehead has the biggest collection of 18th century houses in the entire country. They even have more than Colney of Williamsburg, for instance. Except that in Marblehead, the houses have been continually occupied. On the second floor of a house is an apartment, but the house had been a single family house, been carved into an apartment. High floors were like foot wide. The ceilings were incredibly low, like couldn't stretch your arms over your head because the ceilings were so low. And this is actually when I learned for the first time talking in material culture that bed headboards actually have a function. They're not just decorative. I discovered this because we were so broke in grad school that we would turn the heat down as far as we could manage. And so the room that we used as our bedroom, ice would form on the inside of the windows because it was so cold and we were so broke. And so when we were first living here, we had this futon I'd brought with me, Texas, of course, and there was no headboard. Futon. And so we were freezing, just like having your head up by this wall with ice on the window. We were freezing cold. And it wasn't until we got like a bed with a headboard, like, oh, this is a lot warmer. This is great. Okay, this holy then did I discover that a headboard really is important, at least if you're living in New England. And in this room, the bedroom that we had is hooked under the eaves of the lean-to part of a house. So if you're familiar with colonial architecture, houses tended to be built in stages. You'd have room here and room here. You have, maybe you'd add a second floor and you might add a lean-to in the back to add extra space. So we were in what had been a lean-to. And there was a little door that went into the back stair. And over the back stair, there was this little horseshoe-shaped charm over the back of the door that had been painted over. And of course, horseshoes are something that I think all over the country, we all recognize what they mean. And they mean that they're there for loss of protection. And you see this all over the place. This is a piece of folk magic belief that is incredibly widespread. It's such that we don't notice it, as evidenced by the fact that you buy horseshoe necklaces. Tiffany, wherever. We don't even think about it. But it was interesting to me to see this little remnant piece of magic. It wasn't a real horseshoe. It was clearly there. It's tiny. It was a charm. It had been made as a charm, sold as a charm. And so then I started looking around and seeing horseshoes wherever I went. And it got me thinking, between the fact that there was this little remnant magic shred, that there was that, and also the fact that I was in this physical space that people had been moving through who had been present when the trials were happening. Like, we were only one town over from Salem, whereas when the trials were happening, people were traveling from towns all over the place to come and see because it was a huge spectacle. We were talking about it. So there was one day when I was sitting and thinking, like, someone's foot has been on this board, this actual board under my hand. The same foot was standing and watching what was going on. And something about that tangibility or that proximate tangibility was really moving to me. And it got me thinking about the humanity of people who were living through that very strange moment in time. Because I feel like much of the time their humanity is elided by our presentist biases or what have you. I feel like in highly fantasy versions of witchcraft, the humanity people in the past is elided. And in certainly in Arthur Miller, the actual humanity of people is elided. I started thinking about what became the story in physical women from that perspective, from like occupying this very weird, specific physical space as a stranger and trying to think about what it meant to be in that space and like how it felt to be in this space over this incredible span of years, and how in one sense, the early modern period is this incredibly alien, remote time. Their understanding of how reality worked is very different from our understanding of how reality was. But at the same time, there are certain common elements, common humanity that persist, like lying in bed and being freezing cold unless you have a headboard at your head. And so a lot of my fiction, my desire to like came from thinking about common points of humanity across a wide gaping span of time.
Can you give us a little background on what the situation was in Massachusetts Bay when the witch trials started?
A few things were happening. Question that I get a lot is, what is the proximate cause of the Salem witch trials? What caused it? And the thing that I think is interesting about our question is that it suggests that it would be so much easier if there were just one cause, if we could just point to the thing and be like, oh, that's the thing. When we were corresponding, Josh mentioned the ergot hypothesis. So back in the 70s, somebody floated the idea that maybe all the afflicted bugs, the moldy bread, and was suffering from ergotism, were tripping out of their mind. And that hypothesis was actually dismissed, I think, 6 months after it was first floated, but it still bubbles up periodically in documentaries and popular discourses about because, and I think the reason that doesn't go away is because it's so simple. It's so tidy. You'd be like, okay, that's the thing. And the truth of the matter is there isn't one thing. The way that sometimes talk about it is that it's like a Venn diagram. And Salem is the point of the intersection of all the overlapping circles. So one overlapping circle is the very specific kind of religion that everyone in Salem adhered to. It was a worldview that did not hold that there was anything outside of Christianity. So, for instance, the indigenous population that was already living in Massachusetts at that time, by virtue of not being adherents of Christianity in their very specific Puritan worldview, that which is not Christian is by definition devilish. And it was actually Mary Beth Norton who's made the point that a lot of the language that the people that Salem used to describe the devil is language that is used to describe indigenous people. So one big Venn diagram circle is the specific religious and cultural moment that they're living. Another diagram circle that we could point to is the weather, that the first panicky behavior that erupts with Betty Paris and Abigail Williams, it starts in January. January, super cold in Massachusetts. Cold, dark. The sun sets at 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm not exaggerating. Like, it is dark. Yeah. And that's true in the 17th century today. And also in the 1690s, North America was in miniature ice age. It was even colder and more bitter than it is now in Massachusetts. Another piece is pretty relentless class and gender romantic. So the girls who first experience symptoms that they described as fits are Betty Paris, daughter of Samuel Paris, who's the entrepreneur minister in Salem Dorsch, and Williams, who's his 11-year-old, who's described as being his niece, so that had a different meaning to them than it does for us today. But she was found out to So can you imagine living in a culture where when you can't afford to feed your 11-year-old, you just give her to somebody to live with, for her to work for them. You just give her away. And so Abigail was this lonely, impoverished, starving, freezing child whose job it was to obey everyone, all the time. Oftentimes, I think with great sympathy about Abigail Williams. Poor Abigail, who, by the way, in Arts and Miller's turned into a 17-year-old temptress. She's a child. She's a child. And if you look at the descriptions of her behavior that are described as her being in her fit, a lot of her behavior sounds to me like play, like running around in circles and flapping your arms and saying that you're going to fly up the chimney. Is that devilish possession? Or is it an 11-year-old girl being silly? And I feel like that is the thing of work. So there's the kind of class and gender politics. And that's another bit. So there are a number of different aspects, but you're asking about the politics and the charter. So this is another pretty big circle. So typically, in the early modern period in the colony, someone was accused as a witch. They would be accused and have a trial. And if they were found guilty, by the way, it's hard to find people. They actually had a pretty high bar for evidence at that time. Believe it or not, you could be tried and found guilty. And if you're found guilty, you'd be put to death. And that could happen within a matter of weeks. Salem, the panic begins in January. The first hangings are until June. That's like a huge, long span of time. And the reason for that long span of time is because the Glorious Revolution was unfolding back then. of that time. It's the Massachusetts Charter Hicks, but so they didn't have the legal wherewithal to hold a trial. That's why the Salem trials were conducted by a special court of clay in Germany. They basically had to convene like a special tribunal to deal with this problem. They had come together. In fact, there's some historians who wondered if Court of Oyen Chimney didn't just deal with witchcraft. They were supposed to deal with all the rest of the backlog, but we just don't know what that backlog was because the records of the witch trial weren't survived. And there's another piece of the Venn diagram we have to consider. At the very beginning, the very first person who's accused as a witch was accused by Abigail and Beverly. She's the only person who has less social and cultural power than they did. And there's Tituba or Tituba Indian, who is an enslaved woman during the Paris household. So she's basically the only person who has less ability to protect herself than these children themselves do. And so Tituba's accused. She has two confessions. And there's some evidence that she is beaten in between the two confessions. And in one of the confessions, Tituba introduces the idea of a conspiracy. She says that there is a group of witches at work in Burley. She doesn't know who they are or how many of them. And so at one point, early on, there's actually a sermon is preached in Salem Village that I'm going to mangle the title, but it's something on the event that Christ knows how many devils there are. And so you have this idea of an unknown number of conspirators who must be discovered. When you have this undefined, invisible threat, and also no legal relief. There's no like pressure valve that this tension could be released by because of the like unfortunate timing of the expiration of the charter. So you bring all of these circles in the Venn diagram together. That is why Salem gets as big as it does. And by the time Salem was done, 19 people were put to death, and hundreds had been accused, hundreds in a period of time when a given town had a thousand.
That was a great, thorough explanation of how it took all these different factors to create the situation. It wasn't something, a single bullet theory that you can put to rest.
But I think one reason that we keep craving for simplicity is because the simple explanation for why, then it's easier to assign to history. It would be so much more encouraging, or it would be such a relief to be able to say, oh, his air got poisoned. No big deal. That's solved. But like the fact that what really was at stake was this intersection of circumstances, and that everyone who was a participant in Salem pretty much believed that they were doing the right thing, not only the right thing, but the necessary thing to save their community. That to me is also a moving, but also a terrifying thing to remember in our lives. Because certainly we've all lived through moments where we are convinced that we're doing the right thing and we need to see ourselves perpetuating poorly. And that is, I think that's one of the reasons we as a culture are never really able to let go of Salem.
You said as a culture, we're never able to let go of Salem. Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote, "Shall we never get rid of this past? It lies upon the present like a giant's dead body." I'm wondering what you think he would write now about that.
Hawthorne in particular, someone who, like, he personally so felt the weight of Salem's past in a very personal way, because he was a descendant of Judge Hawthorne, obviously, and because he was living there himself. And for many generations, in fact, during much of the time period Hawthorne was living, the witch trials were not discussed in polite society. This was true into the 20th century, actually. They were not discussed. It is not something that was brought up. It's certainly something my family never talked about until this is something that my aunt and Hubbard. There was a sense of embarrassment attached to it, I think. But I'm also intrigued by the fact that when Hawthorne has tried to grapple, and he has tried to grapple with it, he took a line from, he knew what had happened. Like, he took a line from Sarah Good and put it in the mouth of Matthew Mull in The House of the Seven Gables. Was it Hawthorne who grumbled about damn scribbling women? I think it was. And so this is me tweaking his nose a little bit. But Sarah Good was a beggar, okay? She was destitute. She was one of the first people with tears because she was in no position to defend herself. She's thrown into jail. She has a baby and her, and like toddler, essentially, with her. The baby dies while they're in jail. The toddler, whose name is Dorothy, ends up losing her mind and has to be, like, supported by the town after the trials are all over. So, like, this person is in absolutely dire straits and suffers mightily at the hands of the community where she lives and who's supposed to be helping. And when she's on the scaffold, she says the most badass thing anyone has ever said in history and time. My unbiased opinion, she says, "I am no more than a witch, and you are a wizard. And if you take away my life, God loved you." And I wish I had that kind of wherewithal, because who has that kind of wherewithal under the circumstances? And so Hawthorne takes this line. Hawthorne knows it's happened. And he puts this line in a guy's mouth. I understand that. He's writing in the 19th century. I get it. But at the same time, I think it's impossible to look at Salem and not consider gender politics in place. The fact that virtually everyone who's accused and put to death is a woman. Any man who is accused is associated with a woman who's already accused. Giles Corey crushed to death between stones. He's accused because his wife Martha took him. But also the accusers are initially children, but then also women. So there's a really intense gender politics in place here. So your question was the past lying with the weight of a giant, is what would Hawthorne say today? And I'm actually curious what Hawthorne would say about it today.
I think he would sympathize with or maybe be aggravated by the fact that we're still having the conversation that she was having 150 years. But at the same time, I feel like we're talking about different things from where she was concerned. And also, I think you'd be going more because I write novels.
I love that you brought up that he took Sarah's words and gave them to a man, because it just dawned on me very recently that Ian Putnam didn't read her own apology. I just assumed, and I think that possibly other descendants, we read that, we think, I don't know what we really think about it. We're evaluating what it says anyways, but we're doing that with her voice in our head. And no, it was not.
One thing that continues to interest me as a history person about Salem is that it's one of the rare instances when regular people are at the center of the story. So much of history, especially the further you go into the past, the vast majority of people who have been alive in history of Apple have left no record of themselves. They weren't literate. They weren't of a sufficient note to have their burial place noted. And so much of history, even academic history, as it's gotten more serious about excavating stories, just by the nature of the way that archives come to exist, there's still going to be a bias towards power. There's going to be a bias towards privilege and a bias towards power. And when it comes to Salem, that is one of the rare instances where the bias towards power falls away, because the people who are at the center of the drama are regular people, and where historians have put the work in to try to excavate what is able to be excavated of these lives that otherwise would have been invisible to us. Would we have known Abigail Williams ever existed if she hadn't been part of the Salem trial? We would not have. And in fact, even with her central position at the beginning of the panic, we don't know what happened to her. We don't know where she went. We don't know how old she was when she died. Nobody actually knows for sure. And so particularly talking about people who are not literate, Ann Putnam had her succession read. If I remember correctly, Ann Putnam wasn't literate. And so you're right in saying, here's this apology that she delivered at Benedetta. Yet it was read on her behalf. To what extent was she the author of her own apology? And it's impossible to say. It's impossible to know. And it's one of the reasons that you touched on one of my rant buttons, I'm sorry to report, but as a writer of historical fiction, like, I have so little patience for historical fiction about kings and queens. I don't give a damn about kings and queens. Who cares? They get enough attention. They have enough records. We're all literate. I've been on the documents every single thing about you. And I do not give a damn, because history has paid them enough attention. And I'm so much more interested trying to excavate the history of people who would otherwise be forgotten.
I caught that from you reading Conversion, because
your main character, Colleen, she's getting to give us the firsthand experience like no other afflicted person was able to do.
Thank you for saying that. I confess I haven't looked at conversion in kind of a long time. You're making me think I should look at it again because there's actually a group of high school students and you're reading it right now and I'm going to talk to you next week.
I should read that.
But I appreciate you saying that because I feel like one question I sometimes wrestle with as a history person and someone who's a novelist, what does historical fiction have to offer that nonfiction doesn't have to offer? Like, why not just write a really good history itself? And I feel like in many instances, cases where a story cannot be recovered, that's where historical fiction can be a really wonderful intervention. You can build a credible world with credible material culture, incredible details, incredible politics, incredible ideology,
and then people it with people who are incredibly people. It is a way of accessing history that otherwise is not extant or it doesn't exist. Is there going to be some imagination involved? Obviously. But it is, I feel like that's where the opportunity lies.
I realize we've gotten off Salem a little bit, and I apologize, but it's something that I think about a lot. Like, you know, particularly for some of the story that these readers saw, it's a Salem story.
What does fiction have to offer? Like, why tell a fictional version of this story? And I feel like fiction gives you permission to fill in and shade in the story that where there just is no other shading available. And that to me seems like
I wanted to ask you about the afflicted girls. Do you think it's plausible that conversion disorder could explain some of the fits?
Yes and no. I'll explain that hedge of an answer. For one thing, I find it always a little bit tricky to apply contemporary psychoanalytic categories to people on the path. Like, on the one hand, I believe very fervently in the shared humanity of people in the past. But at the same time, like, we take as natural so many habits of mind that are actually very historically contingent. The fact that you and I might casually talk about what our dreams or what our subconscious motivations might be for something, like, that is indicated post-psychoanalytic. And I think it's tricky to try to access the interior light people who are living in a different moment, especially a moment like the early modern in Massachusetts. It's even hard for a scholar of that time period to really grasp the extent to which Christianity informed every single aspect of existing. So for my second novel, I was working on the physics book I was reading up about, and like, we know about alchemy as this pseudoscientific practice, an early modern practice in which someone tries to turn lead into gold. Okay, fine. But that's actually not what it was. It was actually a way of understanding the order of the universe that took as scientific fact the perfectibility of the human soul. There's this tense layering religion and materiality and mirroring of structures and images. Like as soon as I would get close to thinking I understood alchemical thought, I would slither out of my grasp. And I would realize, because I'm just too much of someone born in the 20th century to I will never actually really understand that intellectual landscape. So when you ask, can conversion disorder explain a girl's behavior? Like, in a way, yes, but in another way, I don't know that we can actually really understand their selfhood, or the way that these girls thought about themselves or understood themselves as individuals. It's just very different from the way that we think. It's very different. So that there's that qualification. With that qualification in place, I would say that, so conversion disorder is where you are under so much stress that your body converts it into physical symptoms. And then mass psychogenic illness is when group of people experience strange behavior together. And there are many examples of MASH psychogenic illness or MASH psychogenic illness expressions of conversion disorder. Multiple examples of it across cultures, across time, across continents, across the history. And it very often happens among adolescent girls for whatever, as we are conditioned to be more like socially engaged with other people. Who knows? We could try to explain it in a number of different ways, but it's not only adolescent girls. I think that it is, this is going to be a controversial thing to say, but like the recent instance of Havana syndrome, a pretty clearly an example of MASH psychogenic illness. That's important to say that MASH psychogenic illness is real. It counts as a real thing. It's not just people like, it's not all in your head. You know what I mean? Like the fact that it is, that it has its origin in mental disorder doesn't make it any less real to the body. Conversion disorder is a disorder. It is your body being sick. It's just that the sickness originates from inside your own organism. That doesn't make it count less.
Not me.
All of it's just to say, did a group of girls start exhibiting strength behavior? Yes. Did it spread from girl to girl along networks of kinship and friendship? It did. But at the same time, their behavior, when you say fits today, that has a very specific connotation. And it sounds like a epileptic seizure or something like that. To us today, if I say, oh my gosh, I just saw this person have a fit, you'd be like, oh no. And you'd imagine that they fell down, twitching, pulling off mouth. But that's not what they were doing. What they were doing was behaving out of the ordinary. So like earlier, we were talking about Abigail running around, flapping her wings and saying her arms and saying, wish, wish, wish. That is her in her fits. Or like another instance of Abigail in her fits is when she challenges Deodat Lawson to name his text. She like gets up in the middle of her church and like mouths off to this very famous divine and rolls her eyes about how boring it's going to be when he reads his text. That's not her having a fit. That's her misbehaving. But her behavior was such a challenge to the gender and economic power structure that was in place where she is living. It was so out of the ordinary that her community could only chalk it up to devilish influence because it was that unimaginable that she would behave this way. So was there a social illness aspect to the afflicted girl's behavior? Certain. Yes. So that's my long and qualified example about our discussion of conversion disorder.
Do you think that they were really afraid of witches and that the fear of witches might have also translated?
Sure. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think the fear was real. I think it is a mistake to either chalk it up as craven opportunism or as naked stupidity or superstition. One of the things that I think is important, I like to give people the benefit of the doubt who live in the past. And that is that, like, absolutely, they were afraid. Can you imagine what does it feel like to live in a world where you really, actually, honest to gosh, believe that the devil can go walk about on the earth? There's a real person and that he can disguise himself as people you know and love and trust. That at any given time, I could be talking to you right now, Josh, and he could be the devil in disguise and I didn't know it. That's it. And it's now we really believe that. We really do believe that. We actually really believe that hell is a real place. You can go there if you make a mistake. That there is no, this is another like aspect of purity belief. Like they can be the elect. The idea that you have no way of saving yourself. That your being saved was only up to God. And you have no control over it whatsoever. Like what? You couldn't build a confession. You couldn't do penance. You could try your best to behave. But it was ultimately just up to God. An existentially dreadful way to live your life. To have no certainty. To live a really hard life, first of all. And to believe that there was such a thing as paradise after death. But to have no idea whether or not you got to go there and that nothing you did made any difference and that everywhere at every turn, the devil was waiting to trick you up. Like, it would not be difficult and an impossible mental landscape to occupy. So yes, if your question was, did they really believe in witchcraft and was that fear, could that fear contribute to their behavior? Absolutely. What a terrifying way to live. And also, what a relief. Like, one of the reasons that I think the witch is such a persuasive idea for so many people at that time was, wouldn't it be great if something was going bad in life to be able to not try to see it as a sign of God's ill favor, but instead to have someone to blame for it? Be like, it's not me. I'm not messing up here. Someone's doing this to me. I think that's also a very human feeling. It's not just bad luck or misfortune or like the luck of the draw. And like so much more of a, no, this person is doing it. They wish me ill, and that's why my life is hard. You know, I think that's a very human belief.
Yeah, we talked a little about Ann Putnam Jr.'s apology earlier, and she still does that in her apology, "The Devil Made Me Do It."
And Samuel Sewell does the same thing. Like, two big apologies that come about after Salem is over, after everything is done, are Ann Putnam's and Samuel Sewell's apology. But Samuel Sewell's apology, too, is weird. When he, like, first of all, he comes to it. It's not that he stops believing in witchcraft or stops believing that there is an invisible world. He comes to it after a series of wonders and marvels, including, if I remember correctly, like his house being pelted with stones. Who knows what really happened? Maybe it was a passing hailstorm. He knows how it took it. But he comes to it after a series of wonders and marvels, and he comes to believe the devil tricked them all. That it wasn't that the devil wasn't luring people into witchcraft. Instead, the devil obscured the minds of the people who were supposed to keep the things. And but also, what a horrifying thing to come to believe about yourself, to look back at your actions and think you're doing the right thing. I think that you are saving your community from the most threatening presence your imagination can come up with. And instead to conclude that no, what happened was that threatening presence tricked you. That you were so weak. That you fooled. Like, what a heinous thing to believe in about yourself. It's a very punishing worldview that this ascribes to.
Do you see any modern parallels to the witch hunt?
Sure. A few years ago, a historian of witchcraft, John Demos, published a book about witch hunting, in which he has a chapter about the 1980s daycare Satanism thing that happened, much of which I was only dimly aware of being a small person in the 1980s myself. But what happened was wicked people were put on trial, actually put on trial, and actually convicted for having run a daycare center and used the children in satanic rituals at the time that it was happening. And this is preposterous. Like, it's actually just like on the surface of it, I think preposterous. I think taken out of context, any of us looking at this would say, this is ridiculous. Obviously, this did not happen. And at the time that it was unfolding, John Demos saw it unfolding and he was like, oh my God, it's Salem all over again. The same pieces are in place. Like, the idea of a conspiracy, the idea of trusted people who cannot trust, the idea of children being at risk. And I think that you see some of the same hysteria and language. I don't like using the word hysteria because it's such a specific word, but you see some of this in like contemporary corners of the conspiracy internet where I try not to spend any time. But that Pizzagate, isn't there some like thing not too long ago about worrying a particular pizzeria was like putting kids at risk in this same kind of way? Like, you see the same kind of like anytime that someone worries that children are, that there will be a lot of riotousness about it, but of course, there's only getting political number, like, of course, children actually literally are at risk by a school shooting, right? Like, the one thing that would really keep children really safe in places where they're supposed to feel safe, trust people around them, is if we restricted access to military assault weapons. That's my opinion. My opinion is that if we really care about keeping children safe, take those down the street, like, full stop. But feel free to send me hate mail. I can reach to catherinehowe.com/content.
So I think asking the question about, are there parallels? We have these modern parallels that are popping into our heads. We have our strong feeling. But what can the understanding of the colonial witch trials and those before do to help us with these parallels? Can it help us? Will it help?
I'd like to think that it can. One of the things that I like to say when talking about Salem is that I feel that one of the reasons we can't let Salem go as a culture. Like, we come back to it and we can't let it go. And I feel that the reason that we can't let it go, among the many reasons, but I think one of the big reasons is that it forces us to confront how fragile our ideals really are. We are an unusual country in that in many respects, we are, notwithstanding those of us who were brought here against our will, which is many of us, but broadly construed, you could argue that we are something of an intentional community, that the only thing that really holds us together is this set of shared ideals, and that some of our shared ideals include religious freedom, they include a social safety net, that we value people who are different from us, that we value people who are vulnerable, bring us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, like that arguably, this is an ideal of what we hold in common. This is an organizing principle of the culture in which we live. And yet, Salem is this instance where everybody, believing they would be the absolute light set, instead put to death the state, put to death 19 people. That in the course of doing the right thing, state did the absolute wrong thing. And they also put to death people who were made and were vulnerable in the community. People who were more likely to be accused were those who were at the most vulnerable, the most out of step, most vulnerable. And so I feel like Salem is an instructive moment for that, because here's this moment where, in the course of being convinced of our total moral authority and correctness, a huge miscarriage of justice took place. And I think that's a really difficult thing to reconcile. And I think especially for a country like ours, where also so many of us are brought up to look to the colonial period for our origin myth. We're told, rightly or wrong, that you're taught to look into the 18th and to a lesser 17th century and see in it the seeds of the country that we would become. Maybe that's another way of thinking about it. Like, another way of thinking about it, is it more productive to think about what you want the future to look like than it is to try to think about past time? That's a question. That's a question that I think is interesting. Well, particularly for an intentional community like ours, where we get to reinvent ourselves as a country, and we get to decide. And what kind of place do we want to be? Do we want to be the kind of place that protects vulnerable people? Do we want to be the kind of place that protects people who are at risk, who are different from us, who are angry, who are grumpy, who read too many books? I would prefer to be in a place that protects these kinds of people, but we get to choose. We choose who we protect.
We can make that choice. And not only is it going to stop suffering here, there are places in this world that are still totally captured by doing the wrong thing, thinking they're doing the right thing, witch hunting. This discussion, it is about us here, but it's about us there. You have referred to time so much. That is such a strong piece of this. Even in conversion, one of the simple quotes you have, it says any number of things could happen in the time it took to go down the hall. You like go right to the time thing. And today when you started talking, you talked about time. And I look at the history. I look at us now. How do we all get caught up on this witch hunting mentality and start looking out for humanity and protecting others?
It's a hard thing. It's a really hard thing. And I wish I had easy answers, but it is, I think simply the act of reflection and awareness is an important one. Stopping to interrogate what our assumptions are.
We've talked about a lot of heavy things. I wondered if we could switch and discuss your new book project. What can you tell us about it?
Oh, so many things. So I'm obsessed with pirates. Who isn't? Hopefully, the answer is everyone is obsessed with pirates. So I have a book coming out in the fall, and I think they're going to let me keep the title. And Josh, Sarah, you guys have to tell me what you think of the title. You ready?
So get comfortable.
Here it is. A True Account of Hannah Missouri's Sojourn Amongst the Pirates, written by herself. That's the title. It's a mouthful. It starts in Boston in 1726 at a very real and actual pirate trial that really did happen. Like most of my stuff, it is grounded in actual fact, and then becomes what I'm describing as a little bit like Gone Girl meets Treasure Island. And I had so much fun with it. I'm really excited about it. And it is a little bit of a departure from what I've done, but it is about a girl, Hannah Missouri, who has to disguise herself in order to escape some pretty heavy circumstances. And she ends up basically stealing away on what turns out to be a pirate ship. And we have to follow her on her adventures. And I have so much fun with some basic pirate tropes. There is treasure. There is a parrot. It's so much fun. And there's also a little bit of romance. And I have the most fun ever in this book.
Sounds like a fun one to read.
Really hope so.
I'm so delighted by what I just heard.
That makes me very happy. Makes me very happy. It's weird because it's one of the, it's probably the most violent book I've written. Y'all have read my stuff and you know I'm a teensy bit squeamish and shy away from. So there's some violence in this book, but what's strange about it is I didn't invent any of it. It is actually all from the historical record. I take no responsibility whatsoever for any of the stuff that happened in the book because it's all, you know, rich from the headlines. It all really happened.
And was Hannah herself based on a real person?
Hannah is based on a couple of people. She's inspired in part by real accounts of Anne Bonny and Mary Read, who are two working class women who ended up disguising themselves as men and going raiding in Jamaica at the end of the 17th century. They're real people. And there was a real Hannah Missouri, who I talk about a little bit in the author's note of the book. She was a 19th century person, and she ended up, I was inspired when I came across her. She was the wife of a ship captain. She was married to a ship captain, and she ended up putting down a mutiny by herself, armed only with a pistol in the Pacific Ocean. And so I read about her, and she didn't have any children. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm obsessed with you. And so I decided to name my awesome pirate after her. Hannah comes from a couple of different sources, so I really like her as a person. She's a tough character.
Yeah, sounds like it. You said that it's set around a pirate trial in Boston?
Yeah, the action starts in Boston in 1726. And in 1726, it's the end of the golden age of piracy. It's actually funny that the Salem period, like the end of the witch craze and the golden age of piracy are at the same time period, which I think is interesting. And a guy named William Fly was tried as a pirate. And the person who turned to him and preached about him was none other than Cotton Mather. So Cotton Mather by then was this like hugely famous, successful cleric, really rich. He had a very popular industry. And so he had taken it upon himself to crusade against piracy. So he tried to bring William Fly and his compatriots back to God. He was there and were hanged. William Fly was hanged and then he was gibbeted. I mean, his body was hung in chain on a tiny island in Boston Harbor Islands and left there to rot. This really happened as a warning to other people who might go out on the accounts, which is a way of describing going, turning pirate. And so I was fascinated by this. It was only 100 years later that excursion boats are starting to leave Boston, like steamboats are going from Boston to New York. This isn't worth time at all to think that you could go by Nix's Mate, which is where William Fly was hanged and chained. You could go by there and remnants, a skeletal remain dangling there. So that's where the action begins as William Fly's trial, and things get even crazier from there.
Sounds like a fun ride.
I'm excited for it. I'm not sure when it's coming out. I think it's going to be November 2023. So, coming up.
Here's Sarah with an important update on what's happening now in your world.
Thank you for listening a few minutes longer to hear End Witch Hunt's World Advocacy News. How many innocent world citizens is it okay to accept as suffering from violent brutalization due to harmful practices related to accusations of harmful witchcraft and ritual attacks? These attacks are happening now to thousands of innocent people who are not causing supernatural harm, but are being punished by their community as if they are the ultimate explanation. They are innocent, not dangerous witches. These attacks are happening across countries of Africa and Asia. Please see the show notes for links to read about how some countries have advocacy groups working to intercede. When there is not an answer for unexpected bad luck, unfortunate death, or personal misfortune, blaming others for supernatural malevolence is the actual crime. This witch fear is still causing unfounded violent attacks against women, children, and sometimes men. Listen and watch for the reports. these attacks are reported on. The Northern Ireland Borough of Larney wants to commemorate 8 witch trial victims from the Island McGee witch trial that took place on March 31, 1711. A borough councillor raised questions very recently of whether the 8 women and a man who were found guilty of witchcraft were actually innocent. In the trial era, using witchcraft was a covenant with the devil against the victims. When this councillor questioned if it is within the council's capacity to say they were innocent, he is questioning if the accused were indeed working with the devil himself to cause harm. Is it within human capacity to not assign witch harm guilt onto others? I want to answer that question right now. Yes, it is within our capacity to stop questioning other people about their status as a supernaturally harmful witch. It is our duty to stop questioning accused witch innocence, past or present. These accused people were not, and today's accused witches are not, causing the supernatural harm that is feared of them. This week, academic research was published that is, quote, a new global data set on contemporary witchcraft beliefs. It has determined that witchcraft beliefs cut across socio-demographic groups, but are less widespread among the more educated and economically secure. Country-level variation in the prevalence of witchcraft beliefs is systematically linked to a number of cultural, institutional, psychological, and socioeconomic characteristics. Altogether, the resulting data set covers more than 140,000 individuals from 95 countries and territories in 5 continents. Over 40% of all survey respondents claim to believe in witchcraft. Stay tuned for a discussion on this research outcome. Find a link to the report in the show notes. While we watch and wait, let's support the victims across the world where innocent people are being targeted by superstitious fear. Support them by acknowledging and sharing their stories. Please use all your communication channels to be an intervener and stand with them. The world must stop hunting witches. Please follow our End Witch Hunt movement on Twitter at _EndWitchHunts and visit our website at endwitchhunts.org.
Thank you, Sarah, for that eye-opening update. Thank you for listening to Thou Shalt Not Suffer, the Witch Trial podcast.
Join us next week for a special Connecticut witch trial victim descendant episode.
And join us in our efforts to end modern witch hunts. Go to endwitchhunts.org.
Subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen.
Visit thoushaltnotsuffer.com.
Remember to tell your friends that you love what you've been hearing on Thou Shalt Not Suffer so that they will not miss out.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.